Hey, everybody. I recorded a conversation with Michael Varhola about really, I started out talking about the book American Nations, the 11 Rival Nations of North America by Colin Woodard. And maybe I got that title wrong. I'm not looking at the book right now. And then a couple things happened. It took me longer than it should have to get the conversation edited and padded out with additional facts and information and presentation and stuff. And I'm midway through that process, but then Vladimir Putin went ahead and ordered the invasion of Ukraine. And suddenly, you know, that podcast topic, I still plan to use the recording and probably in the near future, but it just doesn't seem appropriate to offer that up without really any commentary or analysis on the whole Ukraine situation. And then the other thing that happened is I hurt my left foot. I can't put any weight on it. And my podcast apparatus, the PC and the microphones and everything that I use for podcasting is at a stand-up desk. Now, I have a tall stool that I can sit on at that same desk, but just sitting on that stool, even though I'm not putting any weight on my left foot, just having it, you know, being upright sends all the blood down to that foot and it just aches very quickly as soon as I get up off this comfy chair that I'm on. So I'm in my pajamas. I've got my foot up on a pillow on a footrest wrapped in a compression bandage. I'll put ice on it later. I'm doing everything that I know to do, you know, other than go to a doctor and get an x-ray. I left my cozy Blue State Medicaid in Vermont. So, no access to medical care here in Arkansas. So this will be an interesting podcast. I'm recording it with a clip-on microphone. This is called a Smart Mic Plus, and it's what I use to record my YouTube videos. So those of you who watch the YouTube videos, you would probably recognize it. For those of you who don't, well, it's just clipped onto the garment that I'm wearing, the upper body garment. I'd call it a hoodie, but it doesn't have a hood. But other than the lack of hood, it's basically a hoodie. It is a warm, long-sleeve, zip-up garment. So, Ukraine. No, I think the easiest way for me to organize my thoughts and incorporate the thoughts of people who are Sea Realm adjacent, you know, either longtime Sea Realm listeners, some of them will be Vault subscribers, and some of them, a very few of them, really only or mostly know me from YouTube. So I guess starting in a fairly random place, Greg writes, last time I take Dmitry seriously on anything, so I assume he means Dmitry Orlov. With regard to fossil fuel consumption, I see on one hand a sudden cutoff of supply would be disruptive, but on the other hand, my own experience suggests that there's a lot of fuel, water, cardboard, name your resource, being burned that really doesn't need to be. I'd be curious to see data on how much fat is in the system that could be cut without major impacts on human suffering. All right, so Greg's responding to a video, and I can't reproduce the content of the video just from memory, but somebody had asked me to take in Tucker Carlson's commentary on the day after the invasion. And Tucker Carlson's an interesting case because, you know, he's the devil incarnate for some. When Trump left office and the mainstream media was looking around for a new demon, you know, a new evil personified, they flirted with making it Tucker Carlson for a bit. And then they decided there wasn't enough there. And then, oddly, they settled on Joe Rogan. I'm not going to talk about that right now, other than to say that occasional Sea Realm guest and somebody I know through Doug Lane and Zero Books, Ben Burgess, he just did a nearly 3-hour appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience. So Ben just got the Joe Rogan Experience career boost. Apparently he gained 1,500 Twitter followers the day after his appearance on Rogan. That would essentially double my Twitter followers if that happened. All right, I'm not going to go off on a Joe Rogan or Twitter tangent. let's stick with what Greg is talking about here. So, fossil fuels. Russia has a lot of them. And the Soviet Union built pipelines to take that natural gas throughout the Soviet Union And it was pretty easy, you know, to take it from the edges of the Soviet Union over into Western Europe. And now Germany has gone on a Germany used to have a lot of nuclear power, and they have decommissioned, I think, all of their nuclear plants. And now they are, you know, they've tried to be green with sun and, you know, solar and wind energy. But, you know, Germany's not ideally positioned to be a solar power superpower. So they're dependent on mostly natural gas from Russia and, you know, oil as well. But natural gas is the biggie. And some considerations about natural gas. It burns relatively cleanly, which is to say it produces a lot less CO2 when you burn it than other hydrocarbons do. And, you know, coal is the worst. And of course, you know, there's several grades of coal, and some of them are releasing a lot more than just carbon dioxide, you know, other radioactive elements and sulfur and other pollutants that get released into the atmosphere when you burn coal. So natural gas is relatively clean. It is really cheap right now. It's really cheap because, you know, it's everywhere. Everywhere that you're drilling for oil, you're likely to find natural gas as well, which is mostly methane, but has some other things in it. I used to think that natural gas was just a euphemism, that, you know, it was that if something is natural, it's good, right? So if you call your product natural gas, well, that means it's good. It's good gas. But it's called natural gas because it's usable without being processed right out of the ground. You know, it just comes right out of the ground. You can light it up, it combusts, and you can change that combustion into electricity, or you can change it into, you know, mechanical power, moving vehicles, whatever. It's just usable. You know, you can't really use oil. I mean, you can set oil on fire. You can pour it into a bucket and set the bucket on fire, and, you know, it's a very inefficient, polluting, dangerous nightlight. But it's, you know, to really get much use out of it, you know, to make it propel ships or airplanes or big trucks, it has to be refined. So natural gas is usable straight out of the ground. That's, you know, that's why it's called natural gas. So it doesn't need to be refined. It's plentiful. Right now it's pretty cheap, and it's it burns clean. What's the downside? Well, the downside is it's not very condensed. It's voluminous. It takes, I think I'm getting this right. This is from memory. It would take basically a refrigerator-sized container of uncompressed natural gas to provide enough fuel to cook a Thanksgiving turkey. So it's hard to move. You know, it is a gas. You can chill it. I mean, you can drop the temperature way, way, way down, and it will eventually liquefy. And then, you know, you can transport it in a liquefied state. It's much denser that way, but that's very energy intensive, requires a lot of specialized infrastructure. It's just not practical. Really, the best way, most economical way, safest way, just the best way to move natural gas is via pipelines. To the point where, you know, in the West Texas shale fields where they're fracking for oil, and they're not even looking for natural gas, because they don't have pipelines built out to those well sites, they just flare the stuff. They just set it on fire and release it into the air. Because it wouldn't, if it were economical, if they could make money by shipping, you know, trucks out there to collect the natural gas and then drive it back to a refinery someplace or the head of a pipeline, you know, if fracking companies could make money doing that, they probably would be doing it, right? So Russia's got their Soviet-built Nord Stream pipeline, and they are in the process of negotiating a newer version of the pipeline that takes a different route, which is explicitly designed to move Soviet hydrocarbons to Western Europe for export and sale. Russia has nuclear weapons, lots of them, and delivery systems capable of hitting any U.S. city, or really any city on the planet. President Biden has already said, you know, sending U.S. troops to Ukraine to fight the Russians, not going to happen. And I don't hear anybody pushing back against that, really. Except for the Ukrainians, I don't really think anybody wants to see U.S. troops in Ukraine fighting Russians. That could just go very badly. You know, if it goes badly for Putin, if he feels that there is no, if he's in a no-win scenario, well, then he's going to punish the West and take some, you know, punish the West for humiliating Russia in the days after the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, the possibility for a nuclear strike is there. And, you know, the possibility that the United States is just going to sit there and take it and not respond, not retaliate with nuclear strikes of their own, that doesn't seem very likely. It would be the wisest move. I mean, I hate to say it, but if Russia nuked New York City, the wisest thing to do would be to just take a deep breath and direct all of our attention to providing aid to the survivors of that catastrophe. But human nature being what it is, territorial, prideful, you know, aggressive, retaliatory, in all likelihood, the U.S. would strike back. And then is Russia just going to sit there and take their punishment? Or, you know, is it going to escalate? I notice when people start sentences with, I think we can all agree. Because typically when you're saying that, you're saying that because there isn't agreement on this point. But the tactic is sound. I mean, you're looking for the place of agreement, you know, from which to build. And I think almost all of us can agree, not all of us, but almost all of us can agree that we wish to avoid nuclear war. That a full-scale nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia would ruin things for everybody on the planet. Nobody would escape from that unscathed. Nobody would be better off for that event taking place. And in all possibility, it could be the beginning of the extinction of the human species. That's bad. Again, not universally held that that's bad. I know even some of the people listening to this podcast think that, yes, the universe and particularly the Earth would be better off without humanity. I strongly disagree, but that we're not going to touch, you know, we're not going to engage with that in this podcast. Russia has invaded Ukraine. Almost everybody, you know, except China, disapproves. We all wonder, what can we do about it? Well, economic sanctions, targeted, hard-hitting economic sanctions, except, you know, luxury goods from Italy. Italy's got a carve-out. Their luxury goods can still go, you know, they can still sell their luxury goods, you know, their Gucci shoes and, you know, their expensive handbags, and all that can be sold to the wealthy oligarch class in Russia. You know, you can't hurt the Italian luxury good market. And the Dutch, I think, have carved out an exception for diamonds. Well, you still got to sell diamonds. You know, people are still getting married. You can't not sell diamonds to the Russians. So, you know, when everybody is carving out their protected little niche to make sure that their trade with Russia isn't impacted by these sanctions, it's pretty clear that the sanctions aren't going to be much of a deterrence, particularly since, you know, sanctions, we've been imposing sanctions on Russia for a very long time already. It's really hard to create new sanctions that aren't going to hurt you more than you're hurting the person, you or your friends, you know, than the person you're looking to hurt, which is Vladimir Putin. And I think it's fairly reasonable to say that the goal here is not to punish the Russian people. There surely are people in Russia who think this is a great idea, particularly because of, you know, the bad treatment that Russians living in Ukraine have received from the Ukrainians over the last decade or so. And, you know, if you really want to dig into that, bad treatment, my calling it bad treatment is a massive understatement. We want to punish Putin, and sanctions seems to be the way to go, but nobody really wants to impose sanctions against Russia that's going to hurt them. And the daddy of all sanctions would be, we don't allow Russia to sell its oil and gas. Well, you know what? Everybody needs oil and gas. And if the stuff coming out of the ground in Russia is suddenly not for sale on the open market anymore, well, then the people who were buying that natural gas from Russia have to get it from someplace else. The people buying oil from Russia have to get it from someplace else. And suddenly they're competing on the open market, driving up the price. That's going to hurt everybody. So, you know, the one real sanctions regime that would bite is the hydrocarbon energy sanctions, which it would be enormously painful for Western Europe, particularly Germany, to stop buying oil and natural gas, mostly natural gas, from Russia. And, you know, if you're taking natural gas from Russia, you have to pay for it. You know, they control the supply end of the pipeline. If you're not paying for it, they're not sending it. So what are you going to do? What can be done? And I think the conclusion that I'm coming to, and which I'm not really hearing reflected even in the alternative media, is that while we're all very upset about this, there, unless we're prepared to go to war and risk nuclear war, there's not a whole lot we can do about it. But if you're in the media, or even in the alternative media, if you're just some guy sitting in a chair in Arkansas talking to himself in his room into his phone, you need to talk about stuff. And of course, this is the thing that everybody's paying attention to. So you got to talk about this thing. But really, is there much that can be done? Is there a response that I haven't mentioned? You know, I mean, the obvious response is a military response, but we're not going to do it because we're not going to risk nuclear war. The next obvious response is sanctions. But the only sanctions that would really be effective are sanctions that we're simply not willing to live with the consequences of our having imposed these sanctions. So what's after that? Well, basically, it's name calling. It's shaming. It's controlling the narrative. And yeah, that's certainly being done. But to what effect? Now, I think the thing we should really be focused on, you know, should in the moral sense, is helping the Ukrainian people. But while the active military invasion is ongoing, other than just shipping them supplies and weapons and possibly providing them with intelligence, you know, maybe satellite data on the movement of Russian troops, things like that, I don't know how to help the people of Ukraine. And I'm not even sure that helping the military resistance to the invasion would actually help the civilian population. It might extend the suffering of the civilian population to no good end. You know, it could be that we supply them with weapons and ammunition and intelligence and training, and it just prolongs an insurgency in Ukraine that makes life, you know, still livable, but a lot less pleasant for normal people just trying to go about their daily lives. So what is there to do? Well, analyze, bloviate, opine. And we're doing it. We are doing it. So back to Greg's comment. Greg's talking about all the fat in the system. I'd be curious to see data on how much fat is in the system that could be cut without major impacts on human suffering. Okay, this is something I think we can all agree that yes, industrial society, particularly the way it is implemented now and continues to be practiced, is very wasteful. And it could be organized over time such that fewer inputs, particularly, you know, hydrocarbon energy inputs, would produce maybe less overall commerce, less overall human activity, but a higher level of human satisfaction. Clearly, that's the case. I mean, you just look at any millionaire celebrity suicide to understand that more doesn't always mean better. That you can be rich, you can be famous, you can be loved by millions of people who you don't even know, and you can still be so miserable that you take your own life. And we probably know people. Hopefully, you are blessed to know somebody personally, you know, face to face in your real life, who isn't rich, who isn't famous, you know, who isn't widely regarded and heralded as somebody really special, but who seems to enjoy their life, you know, who seems to be making maybe not the best, but, you know, making good with what, you know, the hand they've been dealt, as we say. So, yeah, we certainly could live better on less. No question. Is that an ongoing project? Well, yeah, for some people it is. Mostly, I think, on an individual basis, or some people, foolishly, I think, you know, once they get on the path of investigating, you know, fossil fuel shortfalls and the potential therefore thereof, and, you know, environmental issues, and the dissatisfaction of living an industrial lifestyle, or even worse, a post-industrial lifestyle where we're all staring at screens all day. I think a natural impulse and one that is, it comes from a, you know, a good-hearted place, but is just, the track record is not good, is, hey, I'm gonna get together with some like-minded people and form a intentional community out in the countryside. So many failure modes for that. And most of them, like new restaurants, most intentional communities fail. And Albert Bates, I forget where I first encountered him saying it, but I've seen it in print several times and I've heard him say it. You know, because most new intentional communities fail, and if you want to be in one, well, the natural thing to do is go and join one that already exists, you know, one that has a proven track record, one that has already worked out how to sustain itself in a pre-collapse world, or in a world that hasn't collapsed and isn't going to, but, you know, they've still found a way to make it work for themselves. You know, the community like that I know the best, because I lived there for a couple of years, is the farm. But, you know, the farm has its issues, and one of those issues is the people who live there are pretty old, and for old people, young people are scary. They want to do things that require resources and a lot of energy and commitment, and you did that when you were young, and now you're tired, and you just want to live your comfortable retirement life. So it's hard for a young person to get established on the farm, and the Ecovillage Training Center, which is Albert Bates's, you know, corner of the farm, is that side door that, you know, people who couldn't get in through the front gate can get in through that side door, meet some people on the farm, make some social connections, and begin the very, very long process of acquiring some status. And I don't know how many levels of status they have for residents on the farm now, but when I was there, it was more than 10. More than 10 different status levels, you know, from the person who has no right to set foot on the property at all to somebody who basically, you know, they've built a house there. They're going to get buried in the cemetery when they die. They're going to be there forever and they cannot be pushed out. You know, I don't know if that's the top tier membership, but, you know, you can get to that level, but it's not a quick and easy process. And it's not something that most people can do. Now, something you can get into a bit more easily is a community, you know, closer to the East Coast. It's called Acorn. And Acorn does have a lot of young people living there. And they also have businesses that sustain them. So they have a hammock making business and a few other things. But I think that the hammocks are the big money maker. But I've heard, and I've never been there, but I've heard from people who did live there for a time. And what they'll tell you is, yeah, there's a lot of young people there. It's sustainable. It's active. But if you're coming from a middle class existence, you know, it's dirty. It's run down. It kind of has the feel of a shanty town. You know, there's mold, there's dust, and there's nobody cleaning it up. Because it's kids. It's young kids. When they're not working, they want to be having fun. Or, you know, they want to be doing wholesome outdoor things like gardening or something. But it's not going to be just a one-for-one replacement with your accustomed middle-class existence. Or even lower middle-class existence. So that was a long diversion. What's the point? Can we live better on less? Yes. Are people working on it? Yes. Are they achieving massive success? As far as I can see, no. Why? Because the larger society has a claim on you. It has a claim on your income. It has a claim on your, you know, your income potential. And if you unplug from the system and go off and try to live by yourself, well, the system doesn't forget about you, and it doesn't relinquish its claims on you. And it's really hard to live unplugged from the system. I think that Ted Kaczynski's cabin has been moved, I think it's to the Smithsonian. It's definitely in Washington, D.C. somewhere. It got disassembled, moved, and reassembled, and it's now an exhibit where people can go and see it. And I forget where it was published, but there was a very detailed description of the cabin before it was torn down and how Kaczynski lived. And basically, it was full of stuff that he bought at Walmart. You know, he lived in his cabin out in the woods with no electricity and no plumbing. In the wintertime, he cut a hole in the floor so he could take a dump through that hole in the floor so he wouldn't have to go outside. But the place was full of Walmart plastic bags, and every few months, he would rent a car and drive to the nearest Walmart and buy all the stuff that he needed in order to stay alive in his cabin unplugged from the grid, you know, separate from the industrial world out on the countryside. His lifestyle was dependent on Walmart. He wasn't unplugged in any meaningful way. Yeah, he may have had a lower carbon footprint than most people, but he certainly wasn't enjoying a higher quality of life, particularly on the social side. In essence, I think my response to Greg is this. Yes, in theory, over the long term, our civilization, if we decided to, we could reorganize such that we need a lot less stuff in order to sustain human beings at an acceptable level of quality of life. If that were an agreed upon priority, agreed from, you know, buy-in from the billionaire class and the people who, you know, who own the legislators and whose will and whose interests are reflected in legislation, if those people decided that the whole world, including themselves, were going to use less and optimize for satisfaction, you know, and human quality of life, over time it could be done. But that's not that's not the agenda. That's not the path we're on. In fact, you know, the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab and his crew, they're not the government. They're basically the oligarch class. And they have a different plan. Their plan is they're still going to live like gods. They're still going to have private jets, enormous yachts, travel all over the world at will. But everybody else is going to live in a pod and eat bugs, own nothing, and be happy. But they realize that, hopefully they realize, that when they just said it out loud and tried to sell it to people like that, people said, no, no. You think it's possible to live that way? You go first. Show us how it's done. And they're not going to go first. They're not going to volunteer to live that way. Nobody's going to volunteer to live that way. But if you don't plan to live that way, but you plan for everybody else to live that way, well, then crisis is your friend. Never let a good crisis go to waste. You know, if there is a sudden catastrophe, if people are thrown into situations where, you know, living in a tent in a refugee camp is better than the alternative, well, then you can get a lot of people used to deprivation and that much lower standard of living in a short time, and you don't even need their consent. In which case, a war, you know, a war in Eastern Europe that creates 5 million refugees, which is the number that's been thrown around in the media as to how many Ukrainians will be fleeing to neighboring countries, and you know they're not going to flee to the east. You know, north is Belarus and Russia. East is also Russia. South is the Black Sea. They're going to go west. They're going to go to Moldova, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, Poland. And now here I am slipping into conspiracy theory territory. The powers that be are looking to manufacture crises in order to immiserate, you know, the vast majority of people and force refugees into wealthy countries and then shame the residents of those wealthy countries into accepting these refugees who are going to, whose very presence will diminish their quality of life. Because if you can generate an enormous hit to everybody's quality of life and then a partial restoration, well, then you've lowered the material inputs and the cost of sustaining the society without sacrificing your own ability to enjoy the best of what technological civilization has to offer. So Greg started out by saying, last time he takes Dmitry seriously. So if you follow Dmitry Orlov at all, you know, since really the breakup of the peak oil crowd, you know that his new focus is just anti-Americanism with a, you know, through a pro-Putin lens. That's basically his daily bread and butter. I still follow him on Patreon. And most of what he posts there to Patreon is behind a paywall. And I am, you know, paying the minimum necessary to read those things. And I share freely. I'll read from just about anywhere, you know, for the podcast here. But the one thing I won't do is read directly from something that's behind somebody else's paywall, particularly, you know, somebody who's not a corporation, somebody who's just a regular, normal content creator like me. Putting words on a screen in order to put money in his bank account. But just from memory, you know, I'm not even going to look, you read through one of his posts and paraphrase it in real time, you know, line by line. But in general, Dmitry's position is that Vladimir Putin and the Russian military, they've done nothing wrong, that this invasion isn't even an invasion. It's just a peacekeeping action. It's sending in Russian troops to protect Russian people from oppression at the hands of, you know, the Ukrainian government. And in particular, Donetsk and Luhansk, two areas in the far east of the country bordering Russia, you know, the pro-Russian propaganda, and it may well be true, but the pro-Russian story is that the Ukrainians have been shelling residential areas in these, you know, ethnic Russian enclaves for years now. And that the West doesn't care, doesn't get reported in the West. And, you know, the Russians are there to fix that situation. And really, the only way to fix it is to take control of the country, to bring the war criminals to justice. And then, you know, over time, I think what he has in mind is that the eastern part, you know, the Russian-speaking, Russian, you know, culturally Russian eastern part of the country will either become a country unto itself aligned with Russia or will be absorbed into Russia. He's not really specific about that. But that the western part, which is where, you know, the Ukrainian speakers live and where they still look back with fondness on their, you know, their Nazi occupation in World War II, that can be the neutral or, you know, the moderately pro-Western but ultimately neutral because they will not be eligible for NATO membership. That can be the buffer region. Is that going to happen? I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. I think, you know, if the efforts and the experience of the United States over the last two decades is any indication, rolling into a country, decapitating the government, setting yourself up there as somebody who is a beloved occupier and an accepted nation builder, that's a tough road to hoe. We haven't had much success in that. We had glorious success in the aftermath of World War II, basically dictating to Germany and Japan how they would rebuild. You know, those are the glorious success stories, but that's going on a century ago now. In the 21st century digital globalized world, that doesn't seem to work very well. Will the Russians have better luck than the Americans? It's possible. But I kind of doubt it. Thank you, Greg, for that comment. Moving on to a different comment. Okay. I don't watch Sagar and Crystal on Breaking Points, you know, with the same loyalty and daily rigor that I did when they were on Rising. But I am checking in with them pretty much daily, you know, now in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And just something that they both agree on, and as far as I know, they've only talked about it once in recent days or the last couple of weeks, and that's the idea that if you're really determined to lock Russia out of the global economy, and what they have to offer to the global economy is energy, well, you got to make up the energy someplace else. And one of the obvious avenues for making up that gap is nuclear energy. I know a lot of people are reflexively and passionately opposed to the expansion of nuclear energy. One such person is Richard Heinberg, you know, of the Post-Carbon Institute. He sent out an email inviting people to give him feedback via this service where you can record your own video and send it to him. And I will share his email because he did send this out to people who weren't paying to read his stuff. And I imagine this is an argument that he would like to see widely shared. So the email is entitled, "Don't Go There. Post-Carbon Institute Quick Take. Dear KMO." It's a form letter, but it's a smart form letter. "Dear KMO, have you been following the news about the Russia-Ukraine crisis?" Well, of course I have, Richard. "I read an article recently by Bennett Ramberg titled The Risk of Nuclear Crisis in Ukraine that examines an important angle of the unfolding geopolitical contest that most people are ignoring. Ukraine has 15 aging, poorly designed civilian nuclear reactors and the smoldering legacy of Chernobyl." I don't think Chernobyl's smoldering anymore. Anyway, Richard continues. Nuclear power supplies half of Ukraine's electricity, but these reactors are vulnerable not just to bombs and artillery fire, but also to cyber attacks. The results of a direct hit or power outage could be apocalyptic for the region. Radiation is no respecter of national borders, and Russia could be among the countries impacted. The takeaway: nuclear power and war are both things we should work against. Where both exist in one place, the dangers are simply unimaginable. There's a lesson here for those who recommend nuclear power as a climate solution. Don't go there. All right, so on the topic of nuclear power and, you know, related topics of interest around the Ukraine invasion, Dan writes, "Thanks for the video, KMO. Always glad to hear you talk. What the heck is going on? Does anyone know? People react to stuff. But if anything, the last 2 years has doubly reinforced in rebar and concrete, it's that what we have going is very nearly chaos. For example, you said that nuclear power would be useful in minimizing suffering. I can go with that, but is minimizing suffering the game plan here? I very much doubt there are many people walking around thinking that nuclear power might minimize suffering on a grand scale. They may think that it would minimize my suffering because I can still have my electricity. I can say, for a fact, that nuclear power has not minimized suffering in Fukushima, Japan." I'm just going to break in here and say, you might say that as a fact, but it is an opinion, and I think it's probably wrong. I think, on the whole, the Japanese people, given the option of living with nuclear energy or without it, they would choose with it, because in terms of homegrown energy sources, they don't have coal, they don't have natural gas, they don't have oil. All that stuff has to be imported. Dan continues, "I can say that it did enrich some land speculators, politicians, and others in the nuclear power business, like GE, Hitachi, and Toshiba, but the people of Fukushima, their relatives, their animals, and the people of Japan in general have suffered. So loads of people are opining on the armed conflict of the day, and some wisely admitting to what they got wrong. But how in the world can anyone get it right? It's chaos. There's no predicting this. There's no way to get trustworthy information to build conclusions on. We might need a Manhattan Project for nuclear power, but even if we are really careful about making sure that this is going to go the way we think it will, I guarantee it won't. I'm not saying you're wrong about nuclear power. I am saying that in the chaos that is our world, there is no way for us, and I'm including Biden and Putin in the us, to have enough credible information to know." So I disagree that the people of Japan, on the whole, you know, in terms of their net well-being, are worse off for having electricity from nuclear power. But I agree with the larger point that we live in a very complex, non-linear, adaptive system that is the global economy, you know, the global power grid, the internet, all these interacting computers and computer systems. And then there's the human element, you know, there's the interacting media sphere, there's the layer of political organization. All of this, it synergizes and it produces nonlinear, unpredictable effects. I absolutely agree. And so, you know, that brings us in general to the question of epistemology, you know. How do we know what we know? And then there's ethics. Why do we do what we do? What's the right thing to do? Well, is the right thing to do the thing that is going to produce the best outcome? Well, as Dan has argued, we don't know what's going to produce the best outcome. You know, we can take all the information that we can get our brains to wrapped around and consider it all and think about, well, if I do this, this will happen. And we do the thing that we think will produce the thing that we want to happen, and maybe the thing we want to happen does happen, but so does something else, something that we didn't expect, something that we don't want. You know, choosing your course of action based on what you think the outcome will be is basically utilitarianism. You're doing what you think will produce the best outcome for the most people. Or it's a more selfish version of utilitarianism. You're going to produce the best outcome for you. You're going to do the thing that you think will produce the best outcome for you and the people that you care about, which may be a very small subset of the much larger us that Dan invoked. So does the unpredictability of living in a very complex world, does it mean that you really can't be a utilitarian? that you can't be a consequentialist? I'm not sure. I'm guessing no. There will always be unpredicted events, unanticipated outcomes, undesired, you know, second-order effects, third-order effects that we know are possible, but we didn't see any reason to think would happen in this particular instance. But in general, things like, you know, if you make a habit of applying yourself and working hard, you're likely to enjoy more material benefit than somebody who is habitually lazy. There's a moralistic element to a statement like that, but there's also a very practical utilitarian or consequentialist element as well. If you do this in general, you're going to get better results than if you do that. If you go to the gym regularly, you're likely to enjoy better health than you will if you don't go to the gym regularly and eat a lot of donuts. That's a consequentialist calculus, and it's pretty reliable. I mean, yeah, you can still get hit by a car, you can still get cancer, you can hurt yourself at the gym, but in general, you can count on the benefits of regular, deliberate physical activity over sloth. You can reliably expect better results from that course of action. How does that apply to nuclear energy? I don't know. I will say that, you know, the Fukushima power plant design is widely criticized, and nobody in the world is suggesting that the power plant be rebuilt according to the same design that was there before, or that any new power plants of that design ever be built, much less Soviet-era, decades-old, built, you know, with the lowest possible standards for safety and you know, quality construction. Nobody's suggesting any more Soviet power plants be built. You know, it's that extremist sort of mentality of framing choices as the absolute worst possible thing, you know, the most negative stereotypical image of a thing. It's either that or it's heaven. It's angelic perfection. You know, and in nuclear power, that works out to either, you know, we build reactors that are a combination of Three Mile Island, Fukushima, and Chernobyl, or we have nuclear fusion. You know, which produces no toxic side effects whatsoever, and there's no danger of meltdown. If the reactor containment is lost, your nuclear reaction stops. You know, basically it just comes to a halt. We don't have nuclear fusion. People have been working on it for decades, and I expect they will still be working on it a couple decades in the future. It doesn't mean it's never going to be built out, but it's not anything that we can count on in the short term. But by the same token, we don't have to just go and rebuild Chernobyl exactly as it was before. And in fact, I don't think anything's going to be built on the Chernobyl site anytime soon, because there is a lot of radioactive material just that's settled on the ground. And if you go and build something there, you're going to stir all that up. You know, that's one of the concerns of the Russian forces traveling through and occupying the site, the Chernobyl site. But there are other types of reactors, which, you know, which have the benefit of not being able to melt down, not being able to explode, you know, not having the same dangers built into them that Soviet era, you know, cheap as cheap can be nuclear power plants have or had, or in the case of Ukraine have. You know, there are still many nuclear power plants from the Soviet era supplying half of the electricity in Ukraine. And yeah, those types of nuclear power plants are bad news on their own. Even in the best conditions, I think they're bad news. But combine that with war, and combine that with the potential for widespread social chaos and collapse and, you know, escape of highly toxic but also refinable nuclear waste products, which could be used in nuclear weapons, yeah, that's catastrophic. You know, that's a catastrophe in the making, and it doesn't take any great stretch of the imagination to push us into a worst-case scenario with that. So yeah, absolutely. No more building nuclear power plants, you know, of the 1980s Soviet design. Okay, but on the topic of nuclear power, I'm vaguely for it, but I'm certainly no champion of it. It's kind of like geoengineering. I think it's something that it would be best to avoid it, but there may come a circumstance where it is the, you know, the least worst option. But I'll give the anti-nuclear folk the final word on the topic for this podcast anyway. Mark posted the following to Patreon. He writes, I'm not sure how anything could be well developed in a minute and 20 seconds. This is in response to Richard Heinberg, who, you know, I read to you his argument against nuclear, you know, building more nuclear. And he summarizes that basically in the beginning of this minute and a half video. But, you know, he could have taken more time to develop a better argument for, you know, a better argument against developing new forms of nuclear energy, you know, implementing newer designs, safer designs. But he didn't. You know, he just pointed out how awful and terrible the Soviet-built nuclear power plants in Ukraine are, and saying, you know, don't go there. Don't do that anymore. Don't make that the future of energy production. Well, nobody's suggesting that. But anyway, Mark writes, I'm not sure how anything could be well developed in a minute and 20 seconds, but I think Heinberg does a pretty good job. He's very clear on the key takeaway. Anyone who wants to build more nuclear time bombs, power plants, as a solution to the climate problem is simply not thinking it all the way through. Even if no nuclear weapons are ever used again, can we feel assured that a stable civilization will always exist and properly tend to legacy remnants of yesterday's nukes and power plants as they continue on their very long radioactive decay path? History says civilizations always fail, fall, and then start again. What happens in the gap? So yeah, what happens in the gap? That's a question that serious people are really struggling with. It's like, we have large stockpiles of nuclear waste that are going to be toxic for thousands of years. How do you warn people thousands of years from now, don't go here, don't touch this stuff, stay away? In all likelihood, you know, in 10,000 years, English won't be the language that humans speak. You know, the symbols that we take for granted, you know, the symbol for radiation, people won't know what that means. How do you warn somebody 10,000 years in the future, if you don't know what language they're going to speak and you don't know, you know, what symbols they use to think in, you just don't know anything about them. How do you tell them, don't touch this stuff, danger, stay away from this? That's a serious question. It's a serious question that, you know, people get paid to grapple with. And as far as I know, they haven't come up with anything particularly useful. So yeah, nuclear power. Not for the faint of heart, and if you're going to take a really long-term view, not just 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, but 10,000 years, 20,000 years, 50,000 years, that adds a complexity, that adds a level of consideration that I think, you know, it is unreasonable to expect that anybody who's in charge and, you know, who is in charge because they were elected is going to prioritize the benefit, you know, the well-being of people tens of thousands of years in the future over their current popularity and re-election prospects. But, you know, there's the deep state. Not everybody's elected. Can the deep state or can corporate executives and officials and board members take a more long-term view? They could. Do they? I'm not in their heads. I'm not privy to their, you know, private conversations. I don't know. So all of this ramble is, you know, it's in response to Ukraine and in response to comments that people have posted to my videos, where, you know, that I've made in the days since the invasion of Ukraine. And, in, you know, looking back and thinking about it and trying to tie it all together, I'm afraid what I'm coming up with is not particularly optimistic or hopeful. We don't dare intervene militarily. We're not willing to live with the repercussions of effective sanctions against Russia. We can take comfort in the fact that, you know, Russia is quite likely to go down the path that the U.S. has gone down in terms of trying to occupy and restructure a country that doesn't want to be occupied and restructured. You know, our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan should be instructive, and apparently Vladimir Putin thinks he can do better than we did. Will he? I mean, I can't wish him good luck, really. I don't wish him success. I don't hope that history vindicates his decision. But at the same time, I don't think that we can ignore the claims that, you know, the Ukrainian government has been very abusive to the ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking population of Ukraine, and it's a sizable percentage of the population. And in the areas where, you know, the Russians are the majority, those are the areas that have been dealt with most harshly by the government in Kiev. In essence, and even, you know, me, even, you know, little KMO sitting in his little home studio. Actually, I'm not in my home studio. I'm just in my comfy chair in my bedroom because of my foot. But, you know, even me, who I really have zero commercial pressure to talk about anything in particular, I feel a need to jabber into a microphone for an hour about Ukraine. But, you know, my ultimate conclusion is there's nothing that can be done. And yet there's no realistic expectation that we can stop jabbering about it. But eventually, and this is a cynical take, which is why I posted it to Twitter, in response to a tweet from Jason Snyder, who I imagine some of you will recognize that name, Jason tweeted, "Explain to me like I'm 12, why is Western Europe still taking Russia's gas if they are so serious about supporting Ukraine?" And I replied, again, this is Twitter, so if it sounds particularly cynical, this is why. I replied, "Because electricity makes life a lot safer and easier. European leaders will drop the virtuous posturing over democracy and sovereignty as soon as the news cycle gets bored with the Ukraine drama and finds some shiny new object to obsess over. The spice must flow." Here's my prediction. There will be no effort made to restrict the sale of natural gas, Russian natural gas, to Western Europe. Joe Biden has floated the idea of U.S. liquefied natural gas supplying Germany, which means shipping it over on specialized, you know, ships that are, you know, they're built to contain liquefied natural gas, which has to be kept very cold and under great pressure. It's very expensive to ship it around in that form. We ship a lot of it to Japan. They buy a lot of it from us. But could we also supply Germany with all of their needs at the same price that they're getting it from Russia? I don't think so. Are they going to volunteer to pay that premium in order to punish Russia? I don't think so. I think that we are all culturally required to obsess over Ukraine for a few weeks, and then we're going to forget about it. And then we'll begin the long-term Russian nightmare of their occupation of Ukraine. And fighting the insurgency and committing all manner of atrocities, and despite, you know, their possibly good intentions, becoming tyrannical in their occupation of Ukraine, and eventually, maybe after a decade or two, slinking out of there in ignominy, you know, as the U.S. just did with Afghanistan. But that's the process that's going to play out over years and decades. It's not anything that's going to obsess, you know, people, it's not going to dominate the news cycle for decades. Very soon, we will get drawn on to something else. In fact, it seemed like there was a lot of excitement and a lot of, you know, careful attention being paid to the details of the military operation in Ukraine on the first day. And by the second day, interest in that was markedly diminished. And now here we are on Monday. And it seems like, you know, interest in that has diminished even further. But I'm, you know, maybe I'm not watching the same TV or listening to the same radio or reading the same news, you know, news stories that you're reading. Maybe, maybe there is still great interest in the minutiae of the military, you know, operation. But I just don't see, I don't believe that it's going to hold our attention at this level for very long. And when the attention of the world has shifted to something else, Germany and other European countries that depend on hydrocarbon energy from Russia will just go back to business as usual. And they will be paying Russia for that much-needed hydrocarbon energy. And nobody in a position of authority is going to make any real sustained effort to prevent that from happening. It seems inevitable. So we'll get a few more weeks of virtue signaling and hand-wringing and the public gnashing of teeth over the Ukraine situation, and then it's just going to fade into the long-term background of geopolitics, much like the U.S. occupation of Iraq. All right, I think I'm going to leave it there. And I'm going to see if I can edit this whole thing on my phone. This will be a challenge. All right. Thank you, everybody, for subscribing. Thank you for your patience when a couple weeks go by and there's no new podcast. Thank you for your support. And thank you, in particular, to the people who provide feedback, either on Patreon or on crealm.com or over on YouTube. Really, it is the feedback that is most important to me in the short term. You know, in the long term, or at least the intermediate term, you know, I've got bills to pay. I've got to make content. I've got to make money. But the thing that, you know, sends me to the keyboard or to the microphone right away with a sense of animated urgency to respond is feedback. So for those of you who don't provide feedback, but you do take an interest, I thank you very much. And I'm very happy with your level of participation. But for those who do provide feedback, extra thanks. All right. I will talk to you again soon. For real now, stay well.